Welcome to America's Cannabis Conversation. Heard every Saturday at 4:20 p.m. online at americascannabisconversation.com. Each week, we provide our listeners information, education, and insight into the exploding medical and adult-use cannabis industry. You'll hear from industry experts, elected officials, local growers, detractors, and more. Learn how to build your own cannabis business, how to grow the product, what's legal, and where it's legal. Tune in each week to hear the latest industry news and updates from the American Cannabis Industry Association in Washington, tips on investing in cannabis, personal success stories, and more. It's time to join the conversation. And here's your host, Dan Perkins.
This is Dan Perkins with your American Cannabis Conversation, 2 minutes and 30 seconds of quick news. The Pentagon, Washington, D.C., the Air Force issues notice banning CBD use regardless of legal status. The United States Air Force published a notice this week emphasizing that service members are not allowed to use CBD products, even though the non-intoxicating compound is federally legal when it's derived from hemp. While the military branch recognizes that CBD is widely available in everything from teas to lotions to pet supplements, it said that current lack of regulation by the Food and Drug Administration poses a risk to members because they could inadvertently consume a product that contains excessive amounts of THC that could show up on a drug test. It's important for both uniformed and civilian airmen to understand the risk these products pose to their careers. Products containing unregulated levels of THC can cause positive drug tests, resulting in the same disciplinary action as if members had consumed marijuana. The Senate Office Building, Washington, D.C. Mitch McConnell presses FDA nominee on CBD and hemp. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky, met with a nominee to become the new Food and Drug Administration Commissioner this week to discuss the need for regulatory framework for CBD products. While there are a few specific details available about their conversation, McConnell said he emphasized the importance of hemp legalization for Kentucky farmers and pointed out that those products are also facing challenges given the lack of FDA regulations concerning CBD. I look forward to working closely with Dr. Hahn on several important issues for Kentucky. Like many Kentuckians who are taking advantage of the hemp legalization, I am eager for the FDA plans to create certainty for these products in our farmers. Oklahoma City. Oklahoma medical marijuana sales far exceeded expectations in less than a year. Oklahoma's medical marijuana industry went from non-existent to one of the largest and most valuable cannabis markets in the nation. According to tax receipts released by the Oklahoma Tax Commission, sales of medical marijuana in the state stood at just over $258 million through the first 10 months of 2019 and are on pace to eclipse $350 million by year end, far surpassing analysts' wildest expectations. Patient counts have skyrocketed through 2019 as well, up to nearly 210,000 as of November 1st. That's more than an eightfold increase in the patient counts, which hovered around 25,000 people. More than 5% of Oklahoma's population is now registered as a medical cannabis patient, exceeding any other program in the nation. And that's your American Cannabis Conversation quick news. I'm Dan Perkins. On the program today, we will have Morgan Fox from the National Cannabis Industry Association talking about the passage of the House Judiciary Bill on cannabis reform. We'll have our money guy, Anthony Plantis, talking about the implications for stocks with this development. We are also fortunate that we'll have Jared Mirsky, who started his company, Wick and Mortar, 10 years ago and is one of the founders of the modern cannabis movement. So we're going to have a good time understanding the history of the business, what he's seen, and what he's looking for in the future. And because we know you're concerned about what's on the label and what's in the bottle, we have a great interview with Mr. Matt Anderson, who's the CEO and founder of Vanguard Scientific. They've developed a unique purifying and extraction process that is taking the industry by storm. Enjoy the show. Welcome back to the conversation, and joining us today is our regular Morgan Fox from the National Cannabis Industry Association, and we're here to talk about specifically the MORE legislation that was reported out of the House Judiciary Committee, ultimately going for a floor vote. Morgan, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me again.
Talk to us about the MORE Act.
I think that it's pretty significant, not only in terms of the potential for actually getting something done in the near future regarding cannabis legalization, but also symbolically. So the MORE Act would basically deschedule cannabis and remove it from the Schedule of Controlled Substances under the Controlled Substances Act, and allow the federal government to regulate it as they choose. It would also establish a cannabis justice department that would then, and it basically puts a 5% tax on all legal cannabis commerce in order to fund grant programs, expungement, and social equity programs at the federal, state, and local level. It allows the Small Business Administration to provide grants to small cannabis businesses. It allows doctors within the Veterans Affairs system to be able to recommend medical cannabis to their patients in accordance with applicable state laws, and it automatically expunges any federal cannabis-related convictions for anyone that's not currently incarcerated, and allows for people to that are incarcerated to be able to redress their cases through the Department of Justice. So this is really one of the most forward-thinking and comprehensive cannabis policy bills that we've seen ever. And it was also the first time that the Judiciary Committee, as well as really any committee in the House, had actually had a markup on a bill to legalize cannabis and remove it from the Schedule of Controlled Substances. So this is a really big deal. And, you know, it got bipartisan support, although much more Democrat support than Republican. There were two Republicans that did vote yes on it. And basically where we're at now is that there are a number of other committees that have jurisdiction in the House, and they can choose to either hold hearings and markups on it themselves or to waive that right in order to speed it to a floor vote.
We're speaking with Morgan Fox from the National Cannabis Industry Association about the MORE Act that was passed by the Judiciary Committee. I understand what you said, is the Judiciary Committee the wrong place for it to have originated, or does it make any difference? Because you talked about other committees that had jurisdiction, so I wasn't quite sure what you were trying to say there.
The bill's original sponsor, Jerry Nadler from New York, is actually the chair of the House Judiciary Committee. Any bill dealing with legalization would have to go through Judiciary at some point, so I think that it's totally fine for it to start there. And, when we were talking about cannabis banking earlier this year in the House, a lot of people were concerned that just passing banking was going to slow down momentum for more comprehensive reforms, particularly those that included additional social justice provisions beyond what was included in the Safe Banking Act in and of itself. So I think that Chairman Nadler was very, very keen to make sure that that did not happen, and to make sure that the momentum kept going. So I think that it's excellent that he honored the agreements and promises that he made to advocates on the Hill to actually bring this up for a markup and to start this conversation on a much more serious footing than has happened in the past. So I think that we're really in a good position right now where we've got a lot of forward momentum. And even if nothing happens again this year with all of Congress being taken up by a lot of different issues and running short on time, we're in a really good position to start the next legislative year.
Do you think that this bill would actually pass the House as it's currently illustrated, or would it have to be changed dramatically?
I think that it could stand a very strong chance of passing in the House if we were to come up to a floor vote today. We'd like to see more robust and clearly defined regulatory language amended in the bill, and we're going to be working with the other committees of jurisdiction to see if we can get something like that introduced as laid out in the recommendations that we released back in October that basically divide cannabis products into four different lanes and then assign chief regulatory responsibilities to those based on the expertise of those agencies. And, we're hopeful that we can get that language introduced in the near future, but it's really questionable about whether there's going to be enough time for even any more hearings or markups on this bill, given that the House still has to work on a final budget for the year, and they have to have that passed by, I believe, December 20th in order to keep the government running. And the fact that there's all sorts of other political things going on, and like I said, the calendar is the window is rapidly shrinking for any normal business to get done in Congress. So to answer your question, though, I think that it very easily could pass. You know, it'll be interesting to see what happens in committee. There will probably be all sorts of amendments added by people who are on the fence about it, or by Republican opposition to try to strip out a lot of its restorative justice power. But whether or not those amendments will actually stay in for any sort of final version that gets a full House vote, I think is pretty doubtful.
This new word that's been buzzing around, this MORE Act, is expungement. And you touched on it a little bit early in this interview. Could you be a little more specific about what the bill says about expungement?
Well, so when the bill passes, as soon as it's implemented, it dictates that there will be immediate expungement for anybody that has been arrested for or has been convicted of cannabis-related behavior, particularly distribution and possession. So this is only applies to federal charges. And it doesn't apply to anybody who is currently incarcerated, but it does provide mechanisms for people to challenge those rulings who are incarcerated and be able to have their cases addressed and potentially have their sentences either vacated or shortened. This is really a great move, but at the same time, the vast majority of arrests for cannabis take place at the state and local level. So it really doesn't address a lot of the unnecessary criminalization that happened to cannabis consumers and people that were involved in, at the time was an entirely unregulated market. That being said, there is language in the bill that allows for this newly formed Cannabis Justice Department to be able to help fund state level expungement programs as well.
So when we're talking about expungement, is that likely to be a major sticking point with the Republicans?
There's certainly a contingent that really is, coming from a law and order standpoint, where if somebody knowingly broke the law, then they should deal with the penalties for that. But I think that more and more people are realizing that cannabis prohibition has been enforced really unequally. And so in order to address that, it's going to be necessary to vacate and expunge a lot of those penalties that weren't doled out evenly to everybody, depending on, race and socioeconomic background. So, some of them might consider it a sticking point, but I don't think that a majority of Republicans do. And regardless, the Democrats currently control the House, and I don't think that there are very many Democrats at all that view that as a sticking point.
So if we look at that, the issue is the people in jail currently, you said, are there primarily because of state issues. Are we going to have to knock these off one state at a time in order to get expungement down to the state level?
I think that that is going to be up to the states. However, as I said, there are mechanisms in order to obtain funding in order to help those programs. And, really at the state level, this is becoming almost a non-issue. Back in 2012, when I was working on the campaign to legalize marijuana in Colorado, we were doing a lot of polling around whether or not we could include some sort of expungement or retroactive amnesty in the language of that bill. And the polling showed that it was an across-the-board bill killer, that there was no way it was going to pass as long as there were any sort of amnesty or expungement provisions written into the initiative language. Fast forward to just this year, where, any sort of legalization bills that don't contain expungement or some form of restorative justice provisions at the state level are pretty much non-starters. So I think that, as a country, we've really come a long way on this particular issue.
So we're speaking with Morgan Fox about the MORE Act. We had the other piece of legislation, which was the Safe Banking Act. Is that doing anything in the Senate?
Well, the Senate calendar just came out a few days ago, and it does not include anything about any sort of cannabis banking. But we are working to make sure that there will be a hearing this year, and if we can't get one this year, then in Q1 of next year. But I think it's important to recognize that up until like a week or two ago, the Senate Banking Committee hadn't actually held a markup on any bill in almost 2 years. So this is a process, and I think that as we get closer to the end of the year, and really start getting into January and February, and Senate leadership starts looking at the political landscape, there is going to be a lot more appetite for addressing this issue, which is not only politically popular among voters of all political stripes, but also could significantly help the chances of reelection for people like Cory Gardner.
We're speaking with Morgan Fox from the National Cannabis Industry Association. Morgan, how can people follow you?
We're available on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and our website is thecannabisindustry.org.
Thank you, Morgan, for joining us. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show.
A programming note. Later today in the show, you will hear from Anthony Planis, who will be talking about more from an investment standpoint. So stay tuned.
America's newest and fastest growing cannabis-focused radio network, W420 Radio Network, is expanding across the country and looking to add to our sales and marketing teams. America's Cannabis Conversation, which airs each Saturday at 4:20, offers listeners insight and information on the exploding cannabis industry. It also gives advertisers the opportunity to reach hyper-targeted audiences, literally neighborhood by neighborhood. We are looking for motivated individuals who want to start their own businesses in markets like Boston, Las Vegas, Reno, Orlando, and more. To get more information on this opportunity or to apply, visit americascannabisconversation.com.
Welcome back to the conversation, and we have an extraordinary guest with us today, Jared Bursky. Not a name that probably a lot of people know, but one of the legends of the business. We've been fortunate enough on this program to have some people who have been around in this business from the very beginning or for a long time. And I had the opportunity to have a couple of conversations with Jared. Fascinating young man and clearly a force in this industry, and that's why we have him on the show. So, Jared, welcome to America's Cannabis Conversation.
Thank you very much for having me.
I want to start with how you got involved in this business.
Sure. Yeah. It was about, 2008. I had participated in a little grow operation with a buddy for fun and for money, of course. It was definitely an interesting time for the cannabis industry, if you could call it that then. But more importantly, in 2008, I started, taking my design skills and web development skills, so to speak, with respect to the agency, small agency I built called Mirsky Media, and started focusing my energy and attention on dispensaries. And dispensaries were really the only types of brands that existed in the cannabis industry other than perhaps High Times hydroponic shops. And so working with dispensaries was, kind of my first go at, really developing a niche-focused agency, really focused on cannabis market. And again, it was only dispensaries because cultivators, they remained in the shadows. They weren't branding themselves yet. This was still very much the black market. I got paid in weed and cash. That was always fun. But nonetheless, that was really when I got my start, was in 2009. That's when I formed a company. And at the time, I had called it Online Marijuana Design. And it wasn't a very creative name, I knew. But, much like the Dollar Shave Club, we had personality. We had grit. And, we wanted to, really show off why we were different. But more importantly, help those within the cannabis industry, again, if you could call it that then, really understand, you know, the role that we were looking to play in the, you know, burgeoning market that is the cannabis industry.
Our audience probably doesn't know this, but I'll help them, because it's what you've accomplished is dramatic as an agency. When you realize that even after it became legal in California, you had no access to terrestrial radio or television. So two ways in which to build market and contact people were off the table and are still off the table. Must have been an incredible challenge for you to figure out, how do I promote with that, with knowing that I can't use radio and TV?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely been a challenge. But I think, you know, all in all, it's also provided a lot of opportunity for us as an agency to come up with far more creative solutions with respect to how we approach bringing brand awareness, driving foot traffic, you know, whatever that, you know, goal or KPI is. But, you know, more importantly, you know, if we're talking specific about, you know, marketing trends within the cannabis industry, and we can, you know, it's good to know that, you know, online marijuana design that then transitions to Wick and Mortar, which we rebranded a few years ago. We've definitely grown our marketing department to reflect what we believe are going to be kind of the, what is the standard of, you know, driving traffic to, you know, these independent businesses. And so let me ask you this question, you know, do you want to talk marketing on, you know, cultivation, or do you want to talk, do you want to talk about dispensary marketing? You tell me.
Well, at least in this segment, what I'm really interested in is you and how you got into business. Explain that, how you've put yourself in a niche in the marketplace that you're a leader. I'm curious, your website, and by the way, before we go too much further, let's tell people how they can get in touch with you. So tell us how that can happen.
You can find me on LinkedIn. I'm very active on there, as well as Instagram. My handle there is at jared.mirsky. Obviously, you can reach me through our website. Yeah, pretty easy to get a hold of. Don't be a stranger. You know, I try to communicate and converse with as many people as I can. At the end of the day, you know, my objective is to add as much value as I can. When I started Wick and Mortar, or really my agency for that matter, my mission from day one was to, you know, change the perception of the cannabis industry on a global level, one brand at a time. And so that's what I intend to do, if that means talking to everyone out there.
Okay, what is the website address?
Wickandmortar.com.
Wickandmortar.com. Okay. So I've been to your website several times. Very impressive.
Appreciate that.
But you, and maybe I'm looking at it in a different way. I looked at it and I see you're also branding, helping brand product, and there's a whole list of images of products that you have brought to the market. Is that where you're headed now, is the branding of product, less than dispensaries?
Oh, well, I mean, you know, again, we're talking about 10 years ago when dispensaries was primarily the only business we could market. So fast forward, you know, a couple of years, and yeah, we're the very first cannabis-focused branding and marketing agency in the world. So, you know, our intentions weren't to become a one-trick pony with the focus of just working with dispensaries. No, you know, we wanted to make sure that we had the ability to touch all types of businesses within the industry with respect to people from all walks of life. I learned early on that, you know, you can learn anything from anybody at any time, so long as you're willing to listen. And it was this saying, the teacher will appear when the student is ready, that always made me think of that. Given the fact that I think when a lot of people who come from the corporate world who enter into the cannabis industry, I'm not saying everyone, but a lot of people, they tend to look at that old, you know, that old stoner grower as, you know, they don't see the value in that knowledge and in that tribal history, that tribal knowledge, right? And there's a lot of value that people can, there's a lot of information that people can learn from those that have been in the space for as long as they have, as long as I have, right? You know, we may not all look the part, but we sure as hell know what we're doing. And I think that's what's beautiful about this industry is it's really done a great job of bringing people from all walks of life together.
I would make an observation, and I would love to hear your viewpoint. I've interviewed a lot of people, and what I find is that an awful lot of people who are founders like yourself in this business tend to come from a retail standpoint background as opposed to biology or chemistry or sciences. They tend to be marketing people who have educated themselves dramatically on what these products can do, but they basically come from a totally different field coming into the cannabis industry. Do you see that in your business too? With the people you're dealing
Absolutely.
With?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, of course. Now we work with people, again, people from all walks of life, those that have come from, you know, growing in the woods of Humboldt to, you know, x-ray technicians to doctors to, I mean, you name it, pro athletes. I mean, we work with a ton of, you know, former pro NFL, NBA athletes, celebrities, artists. I'm in LA right now meeting with a bunch of them, you know, to talk about what we're doing with respect to the brands we're building together. And so, you know, it's a growing market, and there are a lot of, you know, amazing opportunities all over the world. And so, you know, when I knew that I was building my agency, I never had the intention of remaining a local Seattle-based company, which is why we've, you know, captured the global market. You know, we have clients in every medical and recreational state as well as country, ranging from Aurora Cannabis to Candescent to, you know, Neelix to Taboo Brews. I mean, we've had the opportunity of touching quite literally every area of the industry, you know, down to the ancillary side, working with headset and data technology. And it's been great.
Got a couple minutes left, and I need sure. to ask you about, with all the turmoil that's in the business today, especially in California with the illegal market being so much larger than the legal market, and the contamination of product, not only in terms of cannabis, but also in the vaping situation. There seems to be a lot of turmoil. So how do you help your customers deal with that turmoil and that uncertainty and the concerns that the consumer might have?
I mean, I think it provides a unique opportunity to help better position our clients with language that reflects their brand in a way that truly differentiates them, truly highlights those differentiating value propositions, is where most brands rely solely on aesthetic intention to drive consumer engagement, when in fact that isn't the only way to get a customer to purchase your product. There are a lot of ways from a visual language perspective, sure, that you can gravitate a consumer towards that purchase, but there are so many other ways to increase the reoccurring engagement that consumers could have with your brand the next time they go to purchase that, right? Some products look great, but it's shitty quality, right? Or maybe you know, the price point's too high and the product is shit, right? Or, I mean, those are nominal examples, but without getting too nitty-gritty, you could be a brand that's got a low-potency product that's designed to help consumers get off cigarettes and onto cannabis or onto CBD, right? And so it's got a good blend, but because you changed the language from just a low-potency product at a cheap rate because it's low-potency and everyone sees low-potency as cheap, you make it more of a premium product by saying, hey, this is the best formulation for cigarette smokers, so we've engineered this strain or these genetics to specifically help you, you know, move from cigarette. Now, you've got to be careful with claims you make too, right?
Yes.
But again, that's the magic. It's understanding the rules, regulations, the conversation, how to be compliant, And again, without giving out away, without giving out too much gold, you know, again, that's people. That's why people hire an agency versus, you know, hiring a designer to just design something that looks nice, right? It goes far beyond aesthetic intention.
So as we close this, I think you've been extremely helpful, and you've put a lot of ideas, I'm sure, in a lot of people's minds. And just so we can get in touch with you again, and see about having you work with the customers out there. Your website again is what?
You can visit us at wickandmortar.com. That's WICKANDMORTAR.com. You can also find me personally at jared.mursky on Instagram, and just Jared Mursky on LinkedIn. Don't be shy.
All right. Thank you. We've been speaking with Jared Mursky, who is one of the founders of this exploding business, and we're going to have him back on real soon. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
This is Dan Perkins, your host and co-creator of America's Cannabis Conversation. Before we introduce our guest, I want to take a moment to tell you why we started this groundbreaking network and show. Hundreds of thousands of people who work in the cannabis industry trying to help people are not permitted to tell their story on the public airways of radio and TV. In spite of these restrictions, the American cannabis industry is growing at about 35% per year and accelerating. As you listen to this show from time to time, you will hear real people telling their story of how cannabis helped them, or business people who grew their business. When I started talking to people in the exploding cannabis business and telling them what we were trying to do, I heard this common question: when can you help me? Well, we are going to give you a voice. We promise to do our best to bring you a high-value, entertaining program. We want from you what you want from your customers. Come back for more. And now, let's meet our guest.
Welcome to the conversation. This is Dan Perkins, and today we're joined by our regular Anthony Plantis from Banyan Hill Publishers. And we're here to talk about the markets and investing. But today we want to spend a little bit of time talking about the Moore bill, which passed the House Judiciary Committee, passed a pretty remarkable and maybe out there type of piece of legislation on what changes they want to see in the regulation of cannabis. So, Anthony, what can you tell us your perspective of this bill?
Yeah. You know, my perspective of this is that it's a good sign as far as what's going on in Congress and, you know, where the nation is heading. But as far as the Moore Act itself, I'm not holding my breath on it. You know, it's proposing to decriminalize cannabis and to expunge some of the lower level crimes that have been caught up in the criminalization of cannabis, and also a marginal federal tax rate on cannabis. But I just don't see any way that it's going to pass the Senate with the current setup. And so I'm not really that bullish on the Moore Act actually getting signed into law.
Do you think there's a possibility it may not even pass the House?
Yeah, totally. Totally. I'm not certain about the House, but it has a chance in the House. I just don't see any chance in the Senate.
We're speaking with Anthony Plantis. I read the bill, and a couple of things that stood out to me. There's probably much more that you can help me with, but let me give you the two issues that I thought were interesting. I had a number of people as guests on this show talking about the tax burden on cannabis companies and on cannabis product in states, especially where there is a strong illegal market, like California. And so the idea that we're going to tack on another 5% tax on everybody in the cannabis industry to provide for funding for minorities, specifically blacks, to be able to afford to be able to buy dispensaries, veterans benefits, on and on. But what I'm concerned about is that if you've already, and then California, before this thing passed the House, the California state legislature, which was supposedly going to decrease the taxes on cannabis, did a 180 and increased taxes even more on cannabis sales in the state of California. So that one bothered me. I don't see how that's necessarily going to help. And this whole new word that we're going to have to learn, expunging the record, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, Anthony, if you're out of jail, you have a chance to have your record cleaned of a cannabis conviction. If you're in jail for a cannabis conviction, most of the people that are in jail for a cannabis conviction are based on state. So if you were convicted in the state of California and you're in jail, your fight is with the state of California, not federal regulatories. And so that the idea that if you want to try and get out, you got to go through the state system. The government, this bill doesn't help you from a federal standpoint dealing with being incarcerated in a state.
I'm not a legal expert, but I understand it the same way that you do.
Well, you know, there was a lot of flurry when this thing first came out. And then as people began to read it and look at the things, I even had a representative from the National Cannabis Association of America, who will be on the show with you, said to me on the air that he thought that some of these provisions were going to be very problematic for the Senate. But he, like you, said the same thing, that at least it's a step. But I just don't see, as far-reaching as this bill is, getting through the Senate. And I'm not sure that it will necessarily pass the House. And you seem to hold that same kind of feeling. Am I reading that?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I was watching the markets, and when this passed, we saw a rally in both U.S. and Canadian cannabis companies. And then the next day, the cannabis companies totally erased the rally that they had, and the American companies were able to hold on to a bit of it. And to me, that was a sign that you know, a lot of people got really excited when they saw that this was actually passing the Judiciary Committee, and I don't think a lot of people had really, you know, read it or looked into it before that, and so they got excited. And then once they had a moment to actually kind of look at the landscape and everything else, and all things considered, they realized this isn't really something to get hyped up in a singular sense. You know, not exactly just about the MORE Act.
We had the Congress, the House specifically, passed earlier this summer the Safe Banking Act, which is now going to the Senate, but some people say it's not going to do much in the Senate. And now we have this MORE Act, which still has to go to the floor and pass. And then I think it will go to the Senate, but it won't go to a vote at the Senate. It will go to whatever committee Mitch McConnell decides he wants to put it in, and then they'll look at it. And they'll probably change it and have their own hearings, and then they may pass something. But the consensus is aren't enough work days left in 2019 to get anything all done on either of these two pieces of legislation. And then we leave for Christmas and come back after the first of the year, and we're not close to the primaries, and so that things could get stalled on both of these pieces of legislation because of the presidential primaries coming up starting early next year. So they're not going to go anywhere. Do you think that's you agree with that too, Anthony?
Yeah. What I was reading from some lawmakers was that the MORE Act probably wouldn't even go to a vote in the House until sometime in 2020, and they didn't give a date. They just said by the end of 2020. So they're giving themselves a lot of runway to do anything at all with the MORE Act. And like you said, you know, this is going to bump into the primaries, and this is political football. So it almost doesn't even matter what this says. It's about winners and losers and who you're going to give ground to and all that stuff. And so I don't see these controversial bills really, you know, making any headway with the current political environment that we're in.
We're speaking with Anthony Planus, our money guy, here on America's Cannabis Conversation. Anthony, how can people get a hold of you?
Yeah, so you can go to banyanhill.com, or you can search my name, Anthony Planus, on YouTube for all of my weekly videos.
Super. Now we had a conversation the last time you were on. We were talking about what's happening in the equity markets, and I saw an amazing story in Oklahoma this week, where the state of Oklahoma is a medical only. It's on track through the end of the third quarter to look like it could come in at $350 million in medical cannabis sales in the state, that the number of people having the cards that allow them to purchase at the dispensaries has grown from 25,000 to 230,000 in a year. And now they're saying that about 5% of the entire population, state of Oklahoma, has a medical cannabis card. So that's obviously exploding like crazy. Yet there are other parts of the country where it's just gone flat to dead and people are struggling to survive. Is this a regional business, or is it just a matter of flows?
You know, I think part of it depends on, you know, what the state or what the area, what their actual take on cannabis is and the rules and things like that. And so I think in the Midwest, we're seeing a pretty high uptake on the medical side, because cannabis is being used in favor of a lot of other treatment options like opioids and things like that. And you're also dealing with populations that, you know, may not have considered cannabis if it was purely illegal. But now that they have legal, legitimate medical avenue to do so, you're seeing higher adoption rates. It was certainly interesting. One of the people that I talked to in Canada a lot, his family, he comes from a family of doctors. And he was telling me that, you know, a lot of these patients that were using opioids, you know, these are blue collar workers, so their bodies get beat up, and so they need pain medication. They really gravitated towards cannabis as an alternative that had much less impact on their life and on their psyche, but still a meaningful solution to their medical issues. So I think that you may be seeing something like that, you know, in Oklahoma.
So do you think that in your Canadian example, the other impact is the wallet? The cannabis product is considerably less expensive, almost in all forms, than a lot of the other treatments that we're using for pain or whatever. It also is taking less money out of the pocket, which is actually leaving more money in the pocket for the consumer to spend on other things. Do you think that's a factor too?
Oh yeah, I think that definitely comes into play for sure.
So, is there in your mind, is there a point in time where the economics? I think I've mentioned to you about the doctor that I'm working with at Harvard, who is working on treating pancreatic cancer, and his part of his objective is to find cannabis, and he's become very successful in treating a pancreatic cancer with cannabis. And he said to me, one of my interviews with him, he said, I'm looking to create a alternative medicine that every cancer patient can afford. And I've thought about that for many, many times and wondered how long before the traditional pharmacy companies, the pharmaceutical companies, become more of an adopter of creating cannabis products.
Yeah, I don't have a great answer for that. I do know that in the pharmaceutical industry, there's been a huge pivot away from these kind of these broad stroke therapeutics that treat a lot of people but are relatively low cost or low margin, towards you know, treatment options that are very expensive but focus on a very narrow portion of the population. So essentially, mm-hmm. you have people that have no other option, and so you've created the only drug for them, and so you can charge whatever price. And so I think when you look at the pharmaceutical industry very broadly. I don't think we're going to see a lot of players move in, but yeah, certainly we could see a couple names try and develop something like that and capture that. But I think the pharmaceutical industry, ironically, is kind of moving away from that as a general trend.
Wow. We've been talking to Anthony Planas from Banyan Hill Publishers. Anthony, tell us again, before we say goodbye, how do people get a hold of you?
Yeah, you can go to banyanhill.com or go to YouTube and search my name, Anthony Planas, for all of my weekly marijuana updates.
Well, thank you, sir. It's always a pleasure to have you on, and we'll look forward to having you on again. And if you missed any part of this interview with Anthony, you can go to W420RadioNetwork.com, and you can download this show and other shows with Anthony on it at your leisure. So thank you for joining us today, Anthony.
Yeah, thanks for having me, and happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks for joining us on America's Cannabis Conversation.
This is America's Cannabis Conversation with breaking news. Cresco terminates the VitaCann acquisition, highlighting the cannabis industry's focus on savings cash. Chicago-based multi-state cannabis operator Sesco Labs said it's ending its agreement to buy Florida's Vitacom, becoming the latest U.S. marijuana merger and acquisition deal to unravel, and highlighting the steps companies are taking to navigate rocky business environment. Cresco's decision in particular sheds light on how marijuana companies are scrambling to save money, efforts on core markets amid a shortage of outside funding, and falling cannabis stock prices. The vertically integrated company noted in a news release it's saving additional cash through the sale of two cultivation and processing facilities in Michigan and Ohio for nearly $40 million. This has been your America's Cannabis Conversation breaking news. I'm Dan Perkins. Welcome back to the conversation. Joining us today is Matt Anderson, CEO and founder of Vanguard Scientific. And Matt, welcome to the program.
Hey, Dan, thank you. I'm glad to be here. Vanguard Scientific. Sorry for
Vanguard.
The update.
Vanguard Scientific. As I said in the pre-show, I was looking at your material since you and I talked last week. And when you and I talked, we talked about the big issue out there with both cannabis and CBD, and that's it came down to one word: trust. How does the consumer know? How does he trust that what it says is on the label is actually in the bottle, the jar, or whatever? And you've created a magnificent machine that helps in the extraction process. But Matt, if I might ask you, a lot of people don't really know what extraction means as it relates to cannabis or hemp. So take a moment, Matt, and tell us about why extraction is so important in the overall process.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're spot on. Trust is paramount, right? How does the consumer know what is inside of the final product or what's in the bottle, right, is really on the label. Extraction is the process in which you're converting the plant material into the oils and extracts that ultimately go into finished goods. I like to use an example of an oil and gas industry comparison. The crude oil you pull out of the ground is not the same, you know, E85 gas or petrol you're putting inside of your car. There's a lot of different steps that are in between that extraction phase and that final refined oil phase. And then to add another layer to it, you know, the same oil that you're putting in your car isn't the same oil that you'd be putting in, let's just say, a fighter jet. So, again, all oils aren't created equal, and there's purpose-built extraction to get to the specific types of oils that the client's looking for.
So if I said to you, I'm definitely going to oversimplify here. Is extraction simply a process by which you squeeze out the oil that's in the plant material itself? Or is there a different process of how you get it out?
Yeah, exactly. So depending on what small ingredient within, let's use cannabis or hemp for this conversation, you're looking to elicit or extract, you're going to use a different method. One would argue, could you, if you could squeeze it hard enough, right, with low temperatures, you could have a very efficient extraction. Those sorts of methods aren't scalable, so you begin to bring in different methods, solvents, or processes to do it in a cost-efficient and commercially viable manner.
Okay. Let me, I don't mean to put you on the spot. I just want to ask you this question. There seems to be a lot of people in all kinds of different things getting involved in this business, in a business that really is not regulated at the federal level, and the consistency of product from one process to the next is not there. How do you stand about deregulation or decriminalizing and making cannabis no longer a controlled substance, but having the government involved in setting standards?
Yeah, great question. And there was actually, you know, some interesting potential reform that doesn't look like it'll be accepted in the recent act that was filed by Gerald Nadler. But regulation is important. Decriminalization and the fact that the Department of Justice was the one that was named to be a potential participant in the administration of tax dollars at a federal level to regulate the industry is so important. I've spent time with Vanguard internationally and having this conversation in the European markets, and they're putting together a top-down regime, understanding that only through governance, compliance, and regulation will we be able to actually proclaim or declare specific efficacies around these ingredients and give that consumer the confidence or trust that they're seeking.
You know, I had on my last show, I had an attorney from the Federal Trade Commission, and he was talking about the marketing abusiveness at some of these people who are selling CBD products, an oil extraction and then modification, cures Alzheimer's, cures cancer. And the Food and Drug Administration and the Federal Trade Commission are both working overtime with a lot of people out there who are making outlandish representations of what hemp or cannabis can do. There doesn't seem to be any regulation within the industry, Matt.
Yeah, you know, there's an interesting parallel that happened when the natural supplements and nutraceutical industry emerged, let's call it early 2000s, FDA didn't want to recognize a lot of these ingredients or molecules. And what you began to see is organizations like NSF and others stand up to begin self-regulation or third-party commercial regulation of the standards and best practices within the industry. What you saw was the development of trade groups or preferential trade channels that were operating amongst a standard in which they were enforcing themselves through association. And in that way, while there wasn't oversight that was arguably funding or enforcing outlandish claims, the consumer was able to have confidence that a certain body was oversight, right? That there was a, let's call it a neighborhood watch, and these groups were getting certified or approved to be put on a safe list. And that was a way in which the buyer could buy with that confidence they sought. You're absolutely right, though. It is running rampant. And there's far more harm that's being done to the efficacy and the importance of education around these ingredients within the cannabis plants just because people are looking to pick up a quick buck with outlandish claims.
Right. Well, what I want to know now is how can people follow your company and see what you're doing?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. You can go to vanguardscientific.com and get a taste for the company. We don't look or feel much like anyone else in the botanical extraction or systems integration space in this industry, which I believe you enjoy. You can also follow myself on Instagram at inspiredpeople, or you can follow Vanguard on LinkedIn at Vanguard Scientific, or Twitter at Vanguard360.
So now I want to address one issue that we didn't talk about, but that's okay because I'm sure you can handle it. One of the reasons we started this network and this show is that a lot of young people are fascinated by the business opportunity in dealing with hemp and cannabis. How did Matt Anderson get into this business?
Oh, that's a long story. I'll give it to you quick, right? So I built a distillery, a small distillery in my garage in Florida when I was 21 and became an official Moonlight Moonshiner. I ended up launching a spirits company from the kitchen of a French restaurant in a small town called Winter Park, Florida. Ended up partnering in a distillery in Portland, Oregon, and built a portfolio of spirits called Enlightened Grain, which we grew nationally for about 6.5 years. I ultimately sold and exited the business. But during that time, I had, let's just say I don't want to give it an inspiration or give it an accolade, but I was invited to a chef's dinner during one of the wine and food events that happened around our country. And I took Hindu Kush, an Oregon cultivar of cannabis that's purple in color, and infused it into our organic Oregon Tilt certified natural non-juniper gin and brought it to this chef's dinner. I was a hit, and then everyone was a little inebriated. But that was the kind of first foray of crossing into looking at euphorics and looking at cannabis in an adult use setting. I ultimately met with a group that sat between FDA and consumer goods and was happily informed that I was going to be heading to jail if I tried to commercialize that product and put the idea down. I entered again in Florida in Senate Bill 1030, which was 2014, early days. It was a conservative initiative for the manufacturing of efficacious medicines for epileptic children, specifically the Dravet syndrome. And it was a full vertical license application. Growing up in Central Florida and being a part of the community, as well as my background in regulated substances and alcohol at the time, plus the infusion story I told you, all kind of marinated together, presented me, you know, with an opportunity, luck meeting opportunity and preparation. And I got to be a part of a group that ultimately went out and pursued one of those first five licenses and got one under contract and learned an absolute ton. That's about early 2015. I partnered with a small private equity firm out of Austin, Texas, MacArthur Capital, and myself and two partners ended up building two actual portfolio companies. We call them funds here in the United States, addressing a number of different problem statements, as you call it, or opportunities in the cannabis industry. And from there, I was an investor and an entrepreneur for, let's say, the past 3 years. And at the beginning of 2018, I accepted the opportunity to become the CEO of Vanguard Scientific, one of the companies that our initial fund incubated and an initial project that I was an original founder of. So in many ways, I get a chance to be the jockey in one of the most compelling segments of this industry, and I'm just really excited about the road that's in front of us.
As we said earlier, one of the reasons we started this network and channel is a lot of young people are interested in getting involved in the business. And I would say to my audience, go back and listen to what Matt just said. Look at his career path. Look at what he did and where he came and where he is today. It's an amazing story. And you, too, have as much opportunity in the cannabis and hemp industry as Matt Anderson. And I thank you for joining us in this segment today.
Dan, it was an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
We hope you enjoyed the conversation today and invite you to join us next week. So go to the website, americascannabisconversation.com. Download shows and look who's going to be on next week. This is Dan Perkins, and thanks for joining the conversation.
Thank you for taking part in America's Cannabis Conversation.
To hear this show in its entirety or to hear any of our archive shows, log on to americascannabisconversation.com and tune in next Saturday at 4:20 p.m. for the next installment of America's Cannabis Conversation.